Good afternoon. Welcome to the Migration Policy Institute's latest nationwide language access webinar. My name is Chandasi Bundia, and I am a policy analyst with MPI's National Center on Immigrant Integration Policy, and I will be your moderator for the next 60 minutes. Before we begin, I wanted to quickly introduce our speakers and review the agenda for this webinar. We're lucky to have three incredibly dedicated and articulate presenters on the call with us today. All three presenters' bios are included in the accompanying PowerPoint. I'd like to first introduce Amanda Bergson-Shilcock, Director of Outreach and Program Evaluation for the Welcoming Center for New Pennsylvanians. I'd also like to introduce Emma Oppenheim, Manager for Workforce Development Policy Initiatives at the National Council of La Raza. And finally, Dr. Gabriela Limas, Senior Advisor and Director of the Office of Public Engagement at the U.S. Department of Labor. Thank you all for your participation and insights. During the 60-minute webinar, we'll first hear from Gabriela about current U.S. Department of Labor efforts to broaden immigrant integration and LEP worker access to workforce services. Next, we'll hear from Amanda, who will describe current LEP and immigrant worker experiences with workforce services and alternative approaches for serving this population. Finally, we'll hear from Emma, who will outline the current legislative and political barriers that exist for LEP and immigrant workers seeking workforce services under the Workforce Investment Act. When it was passed in 1998, WEA tried to address a critical need in the U.S. labor market to more efficiently and effectively match workers with employers' needs. In the 14 years since WEA was passed, there has been growing acknowledgement that WEA's goal of providing universal access to workforce services has not always been met, and that it has underserved some populations of the U.S. labor market, including LEP and immigrant workers. There are various reasons for this, and this webinar is largely meant to be an exploration of those reasons and how these legislative, regulatory, and implementation impediments have been experienced by LEP and immigrant job seekers. Given the importance of this piece of legislation, the current debate over its reauthorization, and the impact it can have on the lives of LEP and immigrant workers in these challenging economic times, we at the National Center on Immigrant Integration Policy have tried to look at this issue from different vantage points. In doing so, this webinar is the second in our series looking at the Workforce Investment Act. During our first webinar, which is also available on our website, we examined how Illinois and New York State have taken proactive steps to engage LEP workers at one-stop centers. We hope these webinars will help state and local workforce professionals, immigrant advocates, and immigrant services CBOs in their thinking about the current system we operate in and how it can be improved both from within and without. So, without further ado, I'd like to turn the floor over to Gabriela Limas from Department of Labor to start us off.
Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you so much to Chandasi and the Migration Policy Institute for inviting me to participate in this, what I think is a very, very important conversation that doesn't always get added to the agenda related to issues related to folks with limited English proficiency. My name is Gabriela Lemus, and I am a senior advisor to Secretary Hilda Solis of the Department of Labor, as well as the director of the Office of Public Engagement. So I'm just going to begin for a few minutes to discuss a little bit about what the Department of Labor has been doing with regards to not only ensuring that we have access to workforce services for limited English proficient and immigrant workers using our one-stop centers, which are a Workforce Investment Act authorized programs, but also to give a sense of what we have been trying to do and some of the lessons we've learned from different experiences we've had regarding limited English proficiency. So essentially, to begin, the Workforce Investment Act has, like I said, establish a system nationwide of what we call one-stop career centers, and these are designed to provide universal access to all customers. And essentially, the Department of Labor, in conjunction with the Civil Rights Center at the Department of Labor and the Employment and Training Administration, established policies for ensuring meaningful access to services for limited English proficient individuals. We've also, through our Employment Training Office, or ETA, have also invested several types of resources to, one, on three levels. One, to bolster the one-stop career service access overall, but two, to also pilot approaches regarding LEP individuals and how to better serve them. And the third would be the creation of certain online tools in native languages that everyone has access to through the Career One stats. So in terms of the meaningful access, I'm sure you're all aware that back in President Clinton's administration, he created an executive order, 13166, that basically ensures that recipients of federal financial assistance, including our one-stops, must provide meaningful access. So that's sort of the baseline where we begin. And within the Workforce Investment Act services, there's actually a section, 188, that prohibits any kind of discrimination on the basis of age, sex, race, color, and national origin. So those are sort of the legal parameters within which we are working. So basically the kinds of resources that we've created, have a lot of it is dependent on technology and the different websites. So we also use the website www.lep.gov, which includes guidance and resources from across the federal government and catalogs how all agencies implemented that executive order that I mentioned at the top of my discussion. And there is an assessment tool within that LEP.gov website that we encourage our one-stop career centers to use, as well as other recipients of different federal financial support, to determine their current other than English language servicing capabilities or capacities, and how they can plan for providing services to LEP individuals. This is an important tool. It's a language assistance self-assessment, and this is for those grantees who are receiving federal dollars to ensure that, indeed, they are respectful of the meaningful access executive order, as well as the ensuring that there is no discrimination. So I mentioned at the top also that there were three pieces. So one is this pilot approach. So one of our pilot approaches, which is an electronic tool, is called the Occupational Information Network. And it you can go online and look at the website, and it gives you a sort of a sense of how different occupations are worded, et cetera. And this is available in English and in Spanish. Here's a challenge, and I'm going to just be upfront about it. We have not been able, the resources we've received have not been able to keep up with the advances in technology. So it's not as upgraded as we would like it, but it is still a very usable tool. The other is we have something called Career Info Net, which is part of the Career One-Stop, what we call our suite of electronic tools. And this really helps individuals explore career opportunities. And it's also available in Spanish. But it also offers, because part of it, too, I think, is when folks are trying to find jobs, it's also knowing from their experiences, maybe they would not necessarily know how to express their skill sets in conjunction with the job that they're looking for. So this Career Info Net sort of assists them. It's a tool to assist them to figure out which is the best way to go and how to pull together the language necessary for a resume, for example, et cetera. And if they're at the Career One Stop, there are folks on the ground available who can help them. We do encourage our Career One Stops to, especially in those areas with high demographic of limited English proficiency folks, to hire bilingual folks or multilingual individuals to really help improve services. I think where it gets a little challenging is when, you know, the Spanish language, we seem to have that down to a science. The other languages, we're still improving on. It's a challenge. I know that through our teleinterpreters and our 1-877 number that we have, which is the ETA's toll-free hotline, there are 170 additional languages that can be used. And this is particularly useful for folks who are not as internet savvy. And I think it's a valuable tool available. And that number, that toll-free hotline, is 1-877-US 2 and then jobs. And the numbers would be for US 2-872-5627. So, like I said, we encourage folks to the one-stops to hire bilingual staff. One example is in New York State. We have something called the Immigrant Workforce Project, and they offer job-related services to our immigrant and limited English proficient workers at the New York State DOL one-stop career centers. At these centers, you have immigrant worker coordinators to help increase access to employment and training services for target populations. And they also help to train other one-stop staff to better serve customers from other cultures and who are, you know, may speak other languages. Maybe their English is not so perfect, and learning as they're going through that process of really improving their English, they have someone who can explain to them more quickly. Additionally, they also help the one-stop system to be accessible by developing relationships with the CBOs in the area or community-based organizations, as well as other government agencies that serve immigrants and limited English proficient workers. They have the ability to propose new programs and services to serve these populations more effectively and can also help to provide counseling services to the customers directly. So these are some examples, or this is one example. I wanted to, because I'm kind of going on and on here, I just want to kind of help share some things that we've learned, because we've actually, when the Gulf oil spill happened earlier this year, we actually had staff go out on the road, and we really learned a lot about limited English proficient folks who are, you know, in this case, in a natural crisis that led them to really put their job opportunities on the line. And what we learned from the Deepwater Horizon oil spill was also the Mississippi Department of Employment Security, they created a Gulf Coast Recovery Center in Biloxi at one of its one-stop career centers, their what they call their WIN job center. And they invited community organizations, including faith-based organizations like the Lutheran Episcopal Services and the Asian Americans for Change, to participate in that recovery center. So essentially, the organizations were able to use the center as a base of operations, and they could go from there into the impacted communities to seek out individuals needing services. It was a very proactive effort. It was chaired by an API woman, and she would send out five or more of her workers into the Asian fishing communities, because I don't know, most people aren't aware of this, but especially in the New Orleans area, there are a number of Vietnamese fishing communities, and who were really impacted negatively, adversely. They'd already been impacted by Katrina. This additional crisis really put a lot of strain on the community. And all of these workers spoke fluent Vietnamese as well as English. And basically, they were helping folks fill out their claims against VP through the Gulf Coast Claims Facility, and also helping to negotiate services provided at the center and helping them with like lending institutions, et cetera. So literally the one-stop center was a one-stop center. I think as a result of all of this, we've also seen some ample renovations and really a growth in awareness about how to really be culturally appropriate, and not only linguistically appropriate, but culturally appropriate. So for us, I think that that's a very important piece. Additionally, one other thing that we did that I think is important to highlight is we actually created a GED curriculum that was customized to the target populations scheduling constraints and cultural and age considerations. For example, 45-year-old male with limited English proficiency. So a lot of partnerships have been developed. Unfortunately, it took a crisis for that to happen. We hope that instead of seeing this as a negative, that we can turn it around into a positive, and that this will be the types of initiatives that we move forward, we'll continue to engage in.
Great. Thank you. Thank you, Gabby. And can you just repeat that phone number, the EPA hotline that you mentioned?
Oh, absolutely. My pleasure. I got to find it now. It's 1-877-872-5627, and it's actually a toll-free helpline that's for the employment training. Folks can call in and get assistance. Like I said, it's sort of a complementary component to the web-based tools that we have available.
Great. Thank you so much, Gabby.
Can I add one little statement, too, about barriers? Because I know that's a lot of what we're looking at.
Amanda, is that you?
I'm here. Gabby. This is Amanda. I'm here.
Sorry, Gabby. One last statement.
Just that, as in all things government, one of our biggest barriers is resources. And right now, we're looking at some of the most intense budget cuts we've faced in a while. So it's not for lack of willingness. Sometimes we have to get really creative with what we've got.
Yeah, I think everybody on the call can sort of empathize and appreciate the challenging economic times we live in right now. And we all sort of appreciate both the federal government, but also state, local, and community organizations' willingness, despite these challenging economic times, to remain committed to the provision of language access services. So, Gabby, thank you very much for your time. I wanted to switch over now to Amanda from the Welcoming Center for New Pennsylvanians to give us a bit more perspective on what LEP workers face currently, particularly within the Pennsylvania example, but generally when they approach one-stop centers to obtain workforce services. Amanda?
Great. Thanks so much, Chandasi, and thank you, everybody. I am going to be doing a quick run-through today, but I'm also available by email if people have follow-up questions afterwards. Okay. So I wanted to start off mentioning briefly that, of course, as many of us know, barriers for limited English proficient workers go beyond language access. So, of course, language access is important, but there are other barriers, and I'm going to talk about some of those barriers, and then I'm going to talk about some solutions to those barriers, even in the current context we're in. In other words, even in the context of limited resources, even in the context of WEA not being reauthorized. In general, I'm not going to be reading out every word on the slides here, so if there's something you see on a slide that you have a question about, we do have time for Q&A at the end of this webinar. In today's webinar, we are going to be using the Pennsylvania experience as a lens. Just to give you a little context about Pennsylvania, we're a state of about 12 million people. About 500,000 of those people were born in other countries. We have a really diverse immigrant population here. People come from Korea, from Mexico, from China, from the Dominican Republic, from Vietnam. We have a very sizable Haitian population. We have a large West African population, a significant Eastern European population. About half of the immigrants who live in Pennsylvania are already U.S. citizens. And then we also have a significant population of Puerto Ricans, all of whom are U.S. citizens by birth, but many of whom do have limited English proficiency. Pennsylvania is a big state. We've got 67 counties, and our organization, the Welcoming Center for New Pennsylvanians, is focused in the five counties in the southeast corner of the state. So, talking in a little bit more depth about the barriers, one of the barriers that people often have is lack of information, simply not knowing that the system exists or that the one-stops are there. So that's one issue, and we do a lot of work with grassroots, community-based, and ethnic organizations just to inform them about the availability of workforce services. Obviously, also beliefs that people are ineligible, and then fears about accessing services. I don't want to go too much in-depth on this, but for those of you who are running workforce services and don't have a focus on immigrant or LEP clients, immigrants are often concerned about something called public charge, which is a provision in U.S. immigration law that essentially indicates that if you come to the United States and become totally dependent on government benefits, that can jeopardize your immigration status and certainly jeopardize your ability to file for any family members to come to the U.S. There's no actual danger that somebody who uses a workforce service would be subject to public charge, but it is something that immigrants often worry about and that workforce providers may not know that they should be reassuring people about. And then, of course, the saddest example is when somebody attempts to access services but are, for one reason or another, turned away. I want to talk a little bit about the extraordinary task that we give to one-stop direct service workers, including both those who work with job seekers as well as those who do employer outreach. particularly for the one-stop workers who are engaging with job seekers on a daily basis, they're expected to serve a wide variety of special populations, and that includes ex-offenders, people with disabilities, and people with limited English proficiency or people who had the majority of their education and training abroad are another special population. And so it's a particular challenge for the one-stop workers to be fully versed in the needs of any one of these special populations, let alone all of them. So we're cognizant of the fact that they do face those challenges. In particular with foreign educated workers, a couple of things that often crop up in terms of one-stop workers' specialized knowledge in serving that population. We've had examples where people were mistakenly told, oh, well, your master's degree from a home country doesn't matter. You should get a GED in the United States. Or cases where people were told, oh, you need to get your degree evaluated, but there wasn't any guidance given on the fact that, hey, if you just Google credential evaluation services, the first couple of hits that come up are actually scams that have been targeted by attorneys general in a couple of states. And so without giving the worker that heads up that it may look reputable, but it really isn't, that advice can be very dangerous. We also find that one-stop workers are challenged to know all the ins and outs of immigration documents. Changes in the I-9 form a few years ago that meant that naturalization certificates are no longer accepted as proof of work authorization for an I-9. Issues with state-level E-Verify laws. Even in states where E-Verify has not passed as a state-level law, which that's the situation we're in Pennsylvania, there's a bill proposed in the legislature, but it has not passed, there's often widespread confusion both among job seekers and among employers about E-Verify. And then there's very rapid policy changes, including the Haitian temporary protected status that occurred after the earthquake in January 2010 and other issues like that. So those are some examples of the really robust range of specialized knowledge that is required to really give competent workforce services to limited English proficient and immigrant job seekers. I'm going to talk today about things that we can do without Congress doing anything. Professional development training for one-stop workers, subcontracting, and co-locating. All three of these are areas in which the Welcoming Center has firsthand experience. In particular, with professional development, a couple of sort of promising practices that we have found are particularly important are to make sure that direct service workers who may not be specialists are nevertheless available, aware of a few key aspects of the big picture. So, for example, the fact that there are many different types of work authorization, and therefore just saying to a job seeker, do you have your green card? And the job seeker says no, and then the one-stop center worker might deduce from that that the person is not work authorized. Of course, they could be work authorized under many other different statuses. And just on the general point that foreign credentials do have value and that there are organizations that have resources that are specialized, special organizations for nurses, for doctors, organizations like the Welcoming Center that have career guides for immigrant professionals. Making sure that local workforce workers have reference materials, and I'm talking about the most straightforward, common, gotta have on your desk or gotta have bookmarked in your browser, things like the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services instructions for the Form I-9. Sounds very basic. Sounds very straightforward, not something that a one-stop worker might necessarily have at their fingertips. And then having a go-to person to call, whether that's an in-house advocate at the workforce agency or a community-based organization staff member who has expertise in workforce issues and can be sort of on call. Over the past 8 years, the Welcoming Center has subcontracted with a number of in a couple of different counties in the Philadelphia area to provide workforce services. We have funded workforce services to immigrants. And I think a couple of things about that are important to say. First of all, although we do continue to get referrals through the one-stops, 74% of our referrals come through word of mouth. And I think that speaks to both the effectiveness of the immigrant grapevine and the fact that there still is I would say under awareness of workforce services in immigrant communities. We've successfully used public libraries as a really great conduit to getting some information out to immigrant and community organizations, and we at the Welcoming Center have a pretty robust network of ethnic and community organizations that we partner with, but that is an ongoing struggle for one-stops generally. And then, of course, our services are direct job placement services, and I'll talk a little bit more about our model in just a minute. We have placed about 1,100 workers to date in jobs ranging from entry-level to professional positions. And if you're interested in more details about the services we provide and the populations we serve, our website is at the bottom of these slides. It's welcomingcenter.org, and our publications page has a great deal of additional information. I wanted to talk just a little bit about our model before I wrap up this segment here. And so the key points to note about our model, we do a comprehensive individual intake with each individual worker that we see, assessing their foreign credentials, reviewing their work experience, their family and their financial responsibilities, and then what my colleague Yana calls their short goal and their long goal. And the short goal oftentimes being immediate work in what we call a survival level job, a long goal perhaps being able to return to working in the profession for which they were trained, or if they're a person with limited literacy skills or limited English skills, being able to pass a GED, being able to obtain another entry-level workforce credential that will really help them in the future. We use a really shoe-leather approach in terms of our employer relationships, doing individual visits to them before we ever bring a job candidate out on an interview. And then we accompany job seekers on interviews and debrief with them and with the hiring manager afterwards. There's a great deal more we could say about this model, but I'm cognizant of the fact that we started a bit late on this webinar, and I want to make sure we have enough time for questions. So let me get to my last slide here. Some localities, and I know we have a wide variety of folks listening on this call here, some of you may be in urban areas, some of you may be in more rural areas, some of you may be in regions where there really isn't a community-based organization that's positioned in the way that the Welcoming Center is here in Philadelphia to be able to take on this subcontracting role. In those cases, there are alternative approaches. Just fostering increased knowledge between immigration services providers, such as refugee resettlement agencies and church groups and others, and workforce practitioners can by itself have positive outcomes. So one thing that we have on our website is actually a list of English classes in the entire five-county Philadelphia metro region. And that's a resource that we know that one-stop workers and public libraries and others use every day. So there's a number of opportunities for small-scale, low-cost interventions like that that can still improve the immediate services that a job seeker is receiving, either when they're walking in to a community-based organization with a workforce-related question or when they're walking in to a workforce agency with an immigration-related concern or question. And then, of course, the third model is an actual co-location model. The Welcoming Center's office in Philadelphia is located in the same building as a one-stop center. We also have a staff member who spends one day a week at a one-stop center in a suburban county here. So with that, I'm going to wrap up. I will invite people. I know we're going to have an opportunity for questions later, but let me also give you my email address, which is amanda@welcomingcenter.org. And I certainly encourage you, if I glossed quickly over something on this call or if you weren't able to be with us for the full webinar, to feel free to contact me independently and ask whatever follow-up questions you might have. Thanks so much, Chandasi, and I'll turn it back over to you.
Great. Thank you, Amanda. And Emma, I'll turn it over to you to talk about some of the legislative barriers that exist. And my apologies for saying this in front of everybody, but I'm going to just quickly back up to Emma's slides.
Okay. Thanks, Chanasi. And thanks to Dr. Lemus, and thanks, Amanda. And thanks to everyone for your patience earlier on. But so I'm just going to start by taking a trip down memory lane so everybody sort of can wrap their head around how it is that we sort of got to this place where you know, where we sort of, we know the realities of what Amanda and Dr. Lamus are talking about, which is, you know, that there are challenges for limited English speakers just sort of even getting served at a one-stop center. So back in 1998, when the Workforce Investment Act was passed, it's helpful to remember we were in different times. So we were in the midst of an economic boom. Unemployment rate was 4.5%, and the idea was that we would sort of that everybody who wanted to work would be able to work, and that we would have a universal service model for workforce development so that anybody who walked in the door would be able to get services, and that we would have a robust system serving workers of all kinds, all skill levels, and that we would continue to invest in that system to be able to serve everyone. The reality has been a little less rosy, and we've seen disagreement over in the years since over the sort of the relative importance of the priorities under this system that was supposed to sort of serve a dual customer model. And what that means is we were supposed to serve the interests of business and the interests of the job seeker equally. So moving on to my next slide. So NCLR, just as a quick briefing on who NCLR is, that we are the largest Latino advocacy organization in the country. And we have we look at the Workforce Investment Act through the lens of how well it serves Latino workers. And our membership base are about 300 community-based organizations around the country. And these are sort of your bread and butter social service organizations. So they do everything from, with regards to workforce development, everything from very basic employment matching, resume help, interview assistance, to robust hard skills training and linkages with community colleges, career pathways. So when we sort of look at our priorities for a reform of the Workforce Investment Act, we look to our community-based organizations, our affiliates, to really give us their marching orders. And what we've heard from them is that the things that in the system that don't work particularly well are that limited English and basic skills deficient individuals sort of have trouble accessing even the most basic services. They also, across the board, have difficulty accessing training, so accessing those more robust services. The integration of basic education, which includes ESL services, and workforce development, the services intended to sort of help somebody get job readiness skills, are not well integrated. And then finally, the services for youth, for our young people who are often disconnected both from school and from the labor market, there aren't enough services for those youth. So given the background of sort of where NCLR's priorities are, to give you guys a quick update on kind of politically where things are with workforce development with regards to limited English individuals and immigrant workers in general, we know that as a result of the recession and the very slow recovery, more and more individuals have been coming into the one-stops and also into the workforce development system in general, looking for help, again, reattaching to the labor market, upskilling, getting their basic education, getting their English language proficiency, and all of that has happened in the context of dramatically declining resources. So we've seen disinvestment in our workforce development service systems at the exact same time as there's been increasing demand. That is, as an aside, within the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act era, did inject a significant amount of resources into the system, but it was a sort of a one-time shot in the arm. And the picture, aside from ERA, has been one of declining investment. We've also seen disincentives within the system to serve limited English proficient individuals because of the tension that I spoke of between providing a universal service model that sort of opens up the doors to anyone that walks in, and the tension between that and of serving those with more intensive needs. The system actually is sort of inclined to serve individuals who are easier to place into jobs. So while there is, in theory, a universal service model, what we've seen is that on the ground, in reality, individuals who sort of need more of a helping hand are those the least likely actually to get services in the, under the current infrastructure. We have seen some progress. So I mentioned that ERA did provide a shot in the arm, a significant investment of funds. That was an important move for the system. We've also seen guidance coming out of the Department of Labor that has started to make improvements to how states and locals do reach limited English and basic skills deficient individuals. And we have also seen a significant amount of flowering of state and local innovation, sort of despite the fact that the current Workforce Investment Act legislation, as I said, has remained the same since it was passed in 1998. And again, when it was passed in 1998, we were looking at a dramatically different economic and labor market environment. And finally, the other kind of current piece is that we have seen movement. So we saw the Senate release a draft of a WEA reauthorization bill, which did have significant improvements in it, and it had the kind of improvements that NCLR and a lot of our allies have been asking for a number of years. That draft remains on the table in the Senate, where we are hopeful that it will be moved along. We've also seen the president announce and then the Senate release an American jobs bill. So we were pleased with a lot of the content in that jobs bill, and we think that makes significant improvements. And again, in both in ERA, in the jobs bill, and in WEA reauthorization, we see a move toward policy that does take into account the needs of limited English speakers and basic skills deficient individuals. And so quickly on where do we go from here, WEA reauthorization does remain uncertain. So we do hope that we can make progress in the near future, but again, it remains uncertain whether or not we'll see that anytime soon. Funding for the system remains under severe threat, and funding for the system overall means that services for those who do need more of a helping hand are all the more under threat. Again, we have a system that is being asked to serve everyone, and so those who it takes longer and it takes more money to help remain disadvantaged under that structure. We do think that the jobs bill is an important opportunity to inject resources into the system and also to shift the debate away from deficit reduction toward saying that in order to cut the deficit, we really do need to put Americans back to work. And finally, state and local innovation remain more important than ever. And so I'm wary of time, so I'm going to stop right there because I know we don't have very much time for Q&A. But thank you, everyone.
Great. Thank you, Emma. Thanks to everybody on the line for putting up with some of our technical difficulties. I think we're good to go right now. I wanted to ask Emma and Amanda an opening question, but I also wanted to remind the folks on the line that they, in addition to having the option to ask questions via the chat function, they can ask voice questions if they want by pressing star one, and then we can unmute your line. But to start, Emma and Amanda, I wanted to ask about one of the stakeholders in this debate that we haven't really, or we've talked about sort of indirectly, but would like to talk about more directly, and those are the state and local workforce investment boards. What are some of the sort of opportunities that both immigrant services CBOs, immigrant advocates, as well as the one-stop centers themselves, one-stop center staff in particular, what are the opportunities that, what opportunities do they have vis-a-vis the state and local WIBs, and what role should the WIBs be playing in a revitalized WIA?
That's a great question. So I'll take that really quickly, and then I'll hand it off to you, Amanda. But I'm going to give you guys a plug, so I'm going to go first. But I actually think that the Welcoming Center of Pennsylvania is such a great example of what state and local innovation can look like. So if you are, say, you know, as a WIB, either state or local, you know, you are, as I said, you're charged with serving everyone that walks in your door, and the law really doesn't hold you accountable for reaching out beyond those who walk in your door, and it doesn't even particularly hold you accountable for serving those, for giving people that do walk in your door kind of the services they most need. What you are held accountable for are making placement rates and wage gains. So what Pennsylvania has done, I think, is a great example of taking taking a law that really does offer state and local flexibility and saying we're going to do something creative with those dollars. We're going to establish a program that that's sole purpose is to reach out to those who might not be comfortable walking into a one-stop, who might need services that that are more intensive and more specialized than just let's get your resume cleaned up and get you out on interviews.
Well, thanks, Emma. This is Amanda, and thank you for that. A couple of things I would add to that. In terms of state and local workforce investment boards and workforce providers, taking advantage of resources in your community is really important. And I would say there's definitely responsibility on both sides in terms of immigration and refugee services organizations that haven't done as much as they might to inform themselves about the workforce system, but also workforce providers who really aren't familiar with the expertise that may be available in their own communities in terms of ethnic and community-based organizations. So one role that the state and local workforce folks can play is as a convener in explicitly inviting people to the table to talk, to discuss collaborations, to do some informal professional development training with each other's staff. That's something the Welcoming Center has done some of, certainly something we're willing to do more of. And I think that's an important piece. Another piece that I think is really important is understanding that, yes, serving immigrant and limited English proficient workers is in some ways different from serving other workers, and some of the barriers they face are different. But it's also true that with expertise, good placement rates and good wage rates can be achievable for these workers. And so I think it's important to note that, yes, we're all functioning within a system that has some pretty stark requirements in terms of wage gains and things like that, but it is a system that it's possible to work within, and that's something that we've done successfully. We are we're a 501c3 nonprofit. We're not part of the formal workforce system, so it's important to understand that we're free to function in some ways outside of that system. We have additional private foundation money, and we're able to be innovative in ways that perhaps government isn't always able to respond as quickly. But I also want to remind everybody that in the President's budget and approved by Congress, there are funds for workforce innovation grants. And to the best of my knowledge, the solicitation for grant applications on that hasn't been posted yet, but it is something that USDOL is looking at and is hoping and encouraging that states and localities will create innovative approaches. I think creative ways to serve limited English proficient and immigrant job seekers are certainly something that would fall within the umbrella of innovative approaches, and so that's important to note. One other thing I just want to mention is we did have a very successful experience with Recovery Act funding for a CNA, a certified nurse aide program that we ran here at the Welcoming Center, where we had outstanding completion rates and placement rates coming out of that. So we have been encouraged through public opportunities beyond WIA that have been on the table in the last few years. And I think there's room for a lot more growth, both on the part of immigrant services organizations reaching out to workforce, but very much so on the part of workforce reaching out to immigration.
Great. Thank you. You know, we actually have a few voice questions.
So the first voice question is from Charlotte. Charlotte, are you on the line?
Yes, thank you. I'm Charlotte Van Londen, work for the State of Maryland DLLR Adult Ed, and am the ESL specialist. And the first speaker mentioned that the GED curriculum was adjusted to LEP needs. And I wanted to have some clarification on that in terms of what kind of adjustments have been made.
Great. Charlotte, I actually think Gabriela Lemus from Department of Labor, who made that comment, is no longer on the line, but I will try to follow up with her to get you an answer to that. Next person.
All right, so John, are you on the line? All right, Pedro?
Yes, this is Pedro. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Can you hear me now?
Yes. Please go
okay.
ahead.
Okay. My name is Pedro Enriquez, and I work for the Illinois Migrant Council in the state of Illinois. My question is, okay, we're talking about all these changes and all these WIA services practically at 21 of the one-stop centers. One of the problems that I see, okay, with the language barrier is that, yeah, the services are there. Most of the times, if they don't speak English, they're not informed about these services. But the hardest part that I see is, okay, they can be told that there are services for them, but the trainings are not in their language. There are no service providers that are providing training to the populations that we serve that do it in their language when they don't speak English with the LEP populations. How do we solve that?
So I can take that one. This is Emma from NCLR. So it is true that in a lot of areas, so one of the things we've kind of been focusing on, you know, language access kind of at the very front level, at the, you know, you walk in the door of a one-stop and is there somebody who can help connect you to services. And what you're talking about is sort of the next level, which is the more intensive services to meet the individual worker's needs. And depending on your local area, you know, that it is true that that may be a challenge. But in a number of areas, what we've seen is a real flowering of trainings, both basic education and hard skills trainings that are tailored to the needs of English language learners. So we've seen a lot of progress in contextualization of training curricula. And we've also seen a number of community-based organizations, and this I think piggybacks a lot on what Amanda was talking about, but we've seen a lot of community-based organizations and nonprofits around the country take on that work, take on that charge. So they've looked around and they've said, you know what, you know, our community, for example, our community has a wonderful community college that is providing training in, let's say, in the healthcare industry. But we've noticed that those trainings really aren't available to the folks that we work with whose English language level isn't ready for community college classes. And so they've created bridge programming to help people get their English language up to speed to be able to enroll in, say, college-level courses. So you are correct that that remains a challenge, but there has been a lot of progress and a lot of movement in that direction.
Okay, we're going to go to our next question from Loretta. Loretta, you're on the line.
Hi, I'm Loretta, and I'm the Limited English Proficiency Program Coordinator, and I'm here in Oregon. And one of the questions I have is we are trying to update and assist employers by finding people with the right skills, and we have what we call an initial skills review assessment that we offer, and we also have, we're working on the National Career Readiness Certificate Program, and I'm discovering that the certificate program, they're wanting to offer it in English only. And they have a paper in Spanish, in the Spanish language only, that they're willing to offer, but they don't want to offer them the actual certificate. And I'm thinking, how are other states, or how is DOL looking at this to make it more accessible to anyone, whether it's a Cambodian language or an African language, and, you know, not just Spanish?
Sorry, I'm talking a lot. So this actually, I mean, your question is actually quite similar to the last gentleman's question, in that I would say you're absolutely correct. So, you know, there has been a kind of a philosophy that being job ready means speaking English, and so folks are going to need to get their English language up to speed before they can go ahead and do any further workforce development training. And, you know, I think as a system, we've seen a movement away from that and a movement toward integrating the basic education preparation with language skill preparation at the same time. So one of the things that we've seen progress on in the Senate draft of the Workforce Investment Act reauthorization is that there was an acknowledgement of kind of the importance of better integrating adult basic education services, which includes ESL, and workforce development services, which includes the kind of work readiness credentialing that you're talking about. So that's not to say that we can wave a magic wand and kind of fix it, but it is to say that the system is moving in the direction of better integrating those two really important pieces for limited English individuals, and that sort of in the absence, again, of federal legislation, states and locals and community-based programs, I think, are developing programming to address that gap.
This is Amanda. I just wanted to add that at the Welcoming Center, we have a saying that the best preparation for being in the American workplace is to be in the American workplace. And we really don't see English language acquisition and skills acquisition and employment as a sequential process. It's not one thing after the next. It's a mutually reinforcing process where you might get a survival level job where it doesn't draw on a great deal of English language ability, but then you're surrounded by colleagues, you're using English in the workplace, you have the opportunity to take additional classes at night or at a time when your shifts aren't scheduled for work. And it goes to what Emma was talking about in terms of overlap between the adult education system and the workforce system. We've all seen the interesting and innovative work of the IBEST program with community colleges integrating English skills and technical skills for different jobs. But I think it's really important to recognize that we're not doing job seekers favors if we create a separate parallel structure. We're doing them the best possible favor if they're able to access the robust services that are in the existing structure that should be something that they as taxpayers are already paying for and that they have every right to have access to the existing workforce system. So I think a lot of the work that we do is framed around making sure that, yes, we might place a very entry-level job seeker with limited literacy in their own language and very limited English spoken vocabulary in an entry-level job as a laundry attendant, but that's not where she's going to end. She's going to have steps after that. She's going to have a ladder. She's going to have a path, and we're going to be touching base with her as she follows that path to check in and to offer resources and offer support. So I think really it's critically important to understand that we don't see this as a sequential process, and really that this idea that the best preparation for being in the workforce is to be in the workforce cannot be overemphasized.
Great, thank you. So unfortunately, we seem to be out of time. I'd encourage those who tried to provide voice calls to email me at cpandya@migrationpolicy.org with their questions, as well as anybody else who has any questions that they'd like answered. I'll try to follow up with our wonderful speakers after the fact to get your questions answered. Again, I apologize for the technical difficulties earlier on, but I hope this has been a useful, at least introductory conversation into some of the barriers that are inherent in the current WIA legislation and how we can sort of work within the existing system and hope for a better system. I'd like to offer special thanks to Emma Oppenheim and Amanda Bergson-Shilcock, as well as Gabriela Limas, for their presentations and for their participation, both in preparation for this webinar and during these last 60 minutes. And again, please look out for the webinar audio, which will be available soon on the Migration Policy Institute's website, and I'll be emailing out that information shortly. Thank you again for your participation.
For more information and to access past Language Access webinars, please visit www.migrationpolicy.org/languageportal.